Welcome to the Hinckley Institute of Politics. My name is Maher, and I'll be your host for today's forum. The Hinckley Institute of Politics was established in 1965 under the generous bequest of the Nobel Foundation and Robert H. Hinckley. The Hinckley Institute strives to teach students respect for practical politics and the principle of citizen involvement in government. The Hinckley Institute offers internships to students of all majors here locally and in Washington, D.C., and in 35 nations around the globe. Hinckley also offers classes, the nation's only campaign management minor, week-long experiences in D.C., and over $400,000 in academic scholarships. We invite students to go next door or to our website, hinckley.utah.edu, for more information. The title of today's forum is The Challenge of Building a Culture of Peace in the Middle East, by Shimon Chatrit. Shimon Chatrit holds the Chair of Public and International Law at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem in Israel and is the past chairman of the Sacher Institute of Legislative Research and Comparative Law. In recent years, Professor Chatrit headed the International Project on Judicial Independence. He served as on the member of the Israeli Parliament. He was a cabinet minister in the Rabin government and in the Perez cabinet. He served as senior deputy mayor of Jerusalem. He's the president of International Association of Judicial Independence and World Peace. Please join me in welcoming our guest.
Thank you very much, Maya, for your introduction. This is a very honored tradition that the introduction is not done by distinguished professors, but by young scholars. It is my great pleasure and privilege to be associated with the Hinckley Institute of Politics and to hold the Owens Chair of Middle East Studies. And it is also my privilege to speak to you today. I'm very grateful to the organizers, Kirk Jowers, Jane, all the people of the Institute who helped organize this event. The topic of my presentation today is the challenges of building culture of peace in the Middle East. And my intention is to try to go with you in a journey of intellectual and factual expedition into this idea and how it is implemented in our region in the Middle East, but also with some comparative look and comparative examination how culture of peace was built in other places in order to see what lesson could we learn from the experience in other regions. So first of all, let me suggest to you what are the foundations or the pillars of culture of peace that we should seek in proper and good culture of peace. I enumerate four pillars that has to be in a culture of peace if it is to be strong and based properly and has a chance of survival and existence. So the first element or the first pillar is the political and security peace. This will include end of violence, end of hostilities, agreement on borders, exchange of diplomatic relations, and such positive developments after hostilities or after conflict. So this is the first and usually the classic definition of peace. But if you really are looking for a more extended view or more extended concept of culture of peace, you should not be content only with the first element, and you should look also for economic peace. If you look for economic peace, you're looking for tourism, trade, energy cooperation, transportation, movement of goods, movement of people, etc. So the economic peace in the past was not part of this idea of peace, but if you if we take Europe as an example to illustrate this point, certainly the comparison between the First World War and the Second World War, the First World War was only economic and security peace, and the economic peace was not considered at all. Actually, the sanctions imposed on Germany were such that were, according to some analysis, the seeds of the Second World War. The payment of the compensation continued until 2009 by Germany, let's say to the United States, of the First World War. The Second World War ended in a totally different concept, what is called Marshall Plan to diminish the credit of Truman, who was number one. The buck stops at his desk, not at the desk of George Marshall. Nevertheless, the idea of rebuilding Europe, including Germany, including Italy, the idea of rebuilding Europe was the idea of economic peace that is not content only with political security peace, but also expecting to build economic peace. The third element that we seek today in modern concept of culture of peace is not to be content only with the political and security peace, not to be content with economic peace, but to expect the what we call value peace. Value peace means human rights, liberty, democracy, election, judicial independence, and we expect that this concept and this way of life, the democratic way of life, should be part of the culture of peace. And finally, we include also the idea of religious peace. That means acceptance, legitimate acceptance of the culture of others, of the religion of others. Actually, this concept of culture of peace was developed by an international project that is called the Culture of Peace. And one of the organizations was Religions for Peace, that I am the president of, and we thought that it is very important to include this element of religious peace. So these are the analytical foundations of culture of peace, and I want to add element of culture of peace that relates to who are the players in the building of culture of peace. No more do we limit our interest only to countries and states. Today, if we want culture of peace to develop in a world that is dominated by giant corporations, think about Microsoft, think about Intel, think about Siemens in Europe, think about British Petroleum. Their total income or their value could be equivalent to the value of a GDP of a medium country. Let's say Egypt is 260 billion. Israel also is $260 billion GDP. Microsoft value is to about $260 billion. So when we are talking who should be responsible to build culture of peace, not only countries. Today, we expand our expectation to mega corporations, and they should be subject to what we call social responsibility or corporate social responsibility of business enterprises. And we expect them to be subject not only to the strict private laws, private regulations, but we also expect them to be subject to public norms. This will include enforcing laws and treaties and regulations, maintaining fairness, efficiency considerations, yes, but not only profits, bonus and very high pay for senior management only, wrong. The whole echelon of the company should benefit from the success, from the economic success of the corporations. And so to introduce element of social responsibility in the operation of mega corporations is part of the culture of peace. I would skip this idea of how we engage in changing either narrow or prejudicial look or hate concept to a more tolerant and acceptance of the other. This is an analysis by scholars how to achieve this. And I would like more to look at important historical acts that contributed to religious peace. And so I would like to refer to the very important statement which is called Nostra Aetate in 1965. This was the statement that was made by the Catholic Church relative to Muslim religion, Jewish religion, and Hindu, and Buddhism. All of them mentioned in this declaration, and all of them are accepted as legitimate faith. The most relevant and the most crucial is the view, the change in the theological approach of the Catholic Church towards Judaism. As you all know, Christianity considered itself replacement of Judaism. And the change came only almost 2,000 years in 1965 when the Catholic Church defined its approach, a new approach towards Jewish faith. And if you just take a look at the statement relative to the Jewish faith, it is an acceptance of Judaism as a legitimate parallel faith to Christianity. Unlike the previous position that Christianity replaced Judaism. There is also a statement about not holding the Jews or all the Jews as responsible for the death of Christ, of Jesus Christ. And furthermore, as the last sentence says, in her rejection of every persecution against any man, the Church, mindful of the patrimony she shares with the Jews and moved not by political reason but by the gospel's spiritual love, decrees hatred, persecution, displays of anti-Semitism directed against Jews at any time and by anyone. So here we see, in fact, an illustration of religious peace being created between two important spiritual faith, Christianity and Judaism. Following the 1965 Nostra Aetate and the theological clearance, so to speak, of the relationship between Judaism and Christianity, it was possible years later in 1993 for the Catholic Church, in its capacity as the Holy See, the sovereign state of the Holy See, to sign an agreement to establish diplomatic relations between Israel and the Holy See. So we have two tracks. One track is the religious track, establishing coexistence theologically between the two faiths, and the other one, the political and the diplomatic, created at the end of 1993. As part of the whole process, we talk about very important dialogue events that take place in different countries, and particularly by a group that is responsible for this dialogue. Now let us look the development of culture of peace in Europe. We already mentioned that in Europe it started with political and security peace, and then economic peace, illustrated by a Marshall Plan, but beyond what was done in this project of Marshall Plan, rebuilding, rehabilitation, economic rehabilitation of Europe, Europe itself began to develop cooperation internally between the nations. So we see European communities, that is, community of ore, community of coal, community of other elements, and all those communities developed from European communities to a European community, then later on developed to a European Union, then had the Eurozone, and we now, from the seven original countries that formed the original European community in 57-58, we now have 28 countries in Europe, which is a very strong structure of cooperation. And what is important is that during all this period, the constitutional infrastructure, whether it is the initial treaty or later treaties, did not include anything that is relative to value peace. Human rights were not included in the European constitutional infrastructure until the year 2000, when the European Union adopted the Fundamental Charter of Human Rights, or Fundamental Rights, and then amended in 2007. So until 2000, the question is, what was the value peace element of these countries? The answer is that it was a parallel structure called the European Convention of Human Rights. The European Convention of Human Rights supplied, so to speak, American-style Bill of Rights to the constitutional economic structure that was provided by the treaties of the European Union, or the European Community, or the European communities in the beginning. Because all the countries who are members of the European Union are also members of the Council of Europe, which initiated and signed the European Convention on Human Rights. So we see here the development of integration of the human rights element, or the value peace element, into the European Union only the year 2000, 2007, and the final act was in the EU Treaty of Lisbon of 2009. In that treaty, section or Article 6 integrates the European Convention on Human Rights and the general principles of the jurisprudence of that court into the European Union. Now the question is, what is the religious and cultural identity of the European Union? And so the discussion took place before the adoption of Lisbon Treaty. The Pope, for example, was in favor of mentioning God and defining the European Union as Christian entity. The other states who are secularists opposed that approach. And so, in the end, what you see on the screen is the compromise that was adopted to combine both the humanist and the religious inheritance. So the final formula that was arrived at in order to give the definition or the description of the European Union from the point of view of the religious and cultural identity is drawing from the cultural, religious, and humanist inheritance. So humanist is the democratic values, and religious is the cultural heritage, and from which have developed the universal values of the inviolable and inalienable rights of the human person, freedom, democracy, equality, and the rule of law. So we see here a certain solution of a compromise, the combination of liberal ideas, at the same time recognition of the attachment of Europe to its religious inheritance. So inheritance could be replaced for heritage rather than inheritance, but it's a question of language, but the meaning is clear. And so we have the 2000 and 2007, and then the Lisbon Treaty of 2009. Now we come to examine the culture of peace in the Middle East. The culture of peace in the Middle East, when we look at 40 years after the 1973 war, and almost 34, 35 years since the signing of the peace treaty between Israel and Egypt, following the Camp David, the successful Camp David, as distinguished from the 2000 unsuccessful Camp David with Barak and Arafat. So the question, how do we evaluate the elements of the culture of peace as applied to the relations between Egypt and Israel? So what we can say is that luckily and fortunately, the treaty survived many challenges over the last four decades. We did have cold peace, not very warm, we'll analyze it in a minute, but we did have maintenance of economic in one aspect, the QIZ, Qualifying Industrial Zones, but we did have a complete maintenance of the political and security peace. So look what challenges the Treaty of Peace between Israel and Egypt survived. It survived two Lebanon wars, 1982 and 2006. It survived two rounds of fighting between Israel and Hamas in Gaza Strip, cast-led and pillar cloud, and endless series of disagreements between Israel and Egypt on different things. It survived the period of Muslim Brotherhood reign under Morsi in Cairo, and very important, it survived changes that had to be made in the arrangements, the security arrangements, the military protocol between Israel and Egypt that were necessary to be introduced after very serious problems of terrorist attacks in Sinai by insurgents, Bedouin insurgents, and Hamas-supported groups. And there was a need to allow two mechanized brigades from Egypt to go into Sinai. And this was done without any change in the military annex and without any change in the treaty, which shows that the fabric of the relationship between Egypt and Israel is such that it can allow a dynamic change according to the circumstances in order to allow Egypt to meet the challenge of how to deal with the terrorist action, the terrorist attacks that happen frequently in the Sinai. So what we are seeing from the point of view of relations, this has shown the strength of the peace treaty, that it is possible for the two parties to develop adjustments according to changes on the ground. Now, with regard to other aspects of peace, most of the economic element in the peace structure are very, very weak and disappointing. We see public sector initiated boycott, El Al flights from Israel to Cairo stopped because of security problems. The Israeli Academic Center, which used to be very active, including research and academic cooperation, is quite limited now to Hebrew classes for students. There are very, very strong anti-Zionist and anti-Semite programs on television and in the movie theaters. Some ideas that came up didn't succeed so much. Water from the Nile, connection to electrical grids didn't work either. The tourism from Israel, which was in hundreds of thousands immediately after the peace treaty, declined after some terrorist attack and is now almost non-existent. The natural gas that Israel received from Egypt was stopped because of repeated attacks by Bedouins on the pipeline. In the meantime, Israel has discovered large deposits of natural gas in its Mediterranean shores, in the billions of cubic meters, so that Israel now can export natural gas, and this was just in the recent few years. The agriculture project didn't continue, and the total trade between Israel and Egypt is not much, is about 150 million. But there is a light that is shining, and this is what I mentioned before, the QIZ. It's a great success. QIZ is a qualifying industrial zones. It is based on a triangle, U.S., Israel, and a third country, in this case, Egypt, or it started with Jordan. So what is this concept? The concept is that a QIZ region can produce and export goods to the United States with the same benefits of the trade agreement between Israel and the United States. Because trade agreement, until it is developed and approved and passes in Congress and ratified and so on and so forth, takes years. So what they did, they took the platform of the trade agreement and all the benefits that were given to Israel, and they defined the qualifying industrial zones in Jordan as if they were in Israel. But they were called Made in QIZ, and as such enjoyed all the benefits of the trade agreement between U.S. and Israel. What are the trade benefits? No quotas and no custom. So what it did, from 1998, where the, we'll not go into this technical definition of what is qualifying product, but it's the assumption is that a certain part of it has to be transformed in Israel, and that gives it the qualification to be made, to be defined as made in the QIZ. So it was established at the end of 98, and there is a certain structure that oversees it, and look what, in fact, how it developed. We have October 94 peace agreement with Jordan, October 95 trade and transportation agreements, then 97 the first QIZ agreement, and in 98 now about 10 or more areas, and what are the details of this project? 55 factories, over 40,000 employees benefit from this. Jordan export increased from about $15 million to over $1 billion as of the after a few years only. Could you imagine jump of hundreds of percent from $15 million to $1 billion? From 15 million to 1,000 million. Now, at the time when this QIZ was established, Egypt didn't think that it needed it and declined the offer to be part of this project from the beginning. But after Egypt saw the great success of the QIZ, Israel and Jordan, Egypt also wanted to have similar agreement, and in fact, they signed in 2004 similar agreement establishing QIZ also in Egypt. So, if we go back to our analysis, the economic peace can pride itself for the QIZ. All the other elements, unfortunately, we cannot define them as a success, but rather as a disappointing element. So here are the benefits in terms of the details in Egypt. Remember that also there are investments in order to build all these factories, and there are foreign investments that come to these two countries. At the moment, we're talking about substantial amounts, $2 billion export to the United States is very important. Now, you know there is now an ongoing discussion how to define the internal changes in Egypt. Is it a popular revolution supported by the army, or is it a coup that would then mean certain freeze or limitation or according to the U.S. Regulation of the international aid. So I am inclined not to define what has happened in Egypt as a coup, but rather as a popular revolution, the second one, and looking at the changes that started in 2011 as a continuous process. The whole thing started in 2011, and then there was one election, there was disappointment with the ongoing issues, economic and so on and so forth, but of course there are possibilities to define it alternatively as something that is violating democratic principles. But if you assume that the democratic structures have to be somewhat relative and not absolute, then I would prefer that the United States and the United States administration and Congress will be more accommodating to the internal changes in Egypt and not be strict about it in order not to adversely affect the stability of the situation in the Middle East, and particularly given the role of Egypt as a very important leader in Arab countries. In the area of the relationship or economic relationship with the Palestinian Authority, we should mention there is custom union, and there is agriculture cooperation, and there is business-to-business cooperation. The custom union means that all the goods that are imported for the Palestinian Authority, custom is collected by Israeli authorities and transferred to the Palestinian Authority. And that's it's about almost 1 billion shekels, which is 3.5 shekels to $1. So this is a substantial amount that go to the Palestinian Authority. It's important to mention here another project, which is implementation of economic peace, and this is the Red Dead Pipeline Project. You see here the Dead Sea up, and the Dead Sea, and this is the Red Sea. Over the years, there were three options of this project. There was the Med-Dead, Mediterranean Dead Sea. There was Dead-Med, Dead Sea, Mediterranean. Red-Med, excuse me. Red-Med, Dead-Med, and Red-Dead. Okay? So in the end, we stuck with Red-Dead. And the idea is that this project will generate water, will help to solve some of the problems of the Dead Sea because of the lack of water and the drying up. And thirdly, attract some investments in this area for tourism. So this was done just in September. The three parties signed an agreement to develop this Red Dead. It is pipeline and not canal, which solves some of the environmental issues that were raised by environmental group. And this will include the water purification, will be built by the three countries, by the three participants. And it will carry 100 million metric cubes of water to the north annually, and this will be shared by the three group. 80 million will be desalinated in a special facility to be built in the Jordanian city of Aqaba, which is next to the Red Sea, and 3 to 50 million cubic meters will be allocated to Israel for usage in Arava and Eilat, and the rest will be given. So this is, again, another element which is very positive in the economic peace. I now want to just show you illustrations, but I don't know where the item is on the screen. Let's see. I'm not a Mac man, I am a Lenovo man. So we see if we can succeed to find the other guy. Maher, could you help me?
Is it in your flash drive?
This is the other attachment that I want to show you, the activities of the International Project of Judicial Culture of Peace.
Do you know if it's in here? The flash drive? Is it in this flash drive?
That's possible, okay.
Did you send it to us like over email or?
Over the email.
Over email, okay. Jane, did you get the email that he sent?
Okay, so I'll just tell you, and then we'll go for questions. No, that's not the one. Our coalition of Culture of Peace has held conferences over the years in Amman, in Casablanca, in Cairo, in Gafla, in Liechtenstein, in Trento, in Aqaba, and it promoted this vision of culture of peace that we discussed today. And we had in these meetings participation of people from the highest level. Just to give you examples, in Trento, which is in Italy, we had participation from a number of very senior officials. In Aqaba, Prince Hassan took part. For the dialogue and the continuous analysis, and so the idea is that we should try to get people to meet, to understand, and just to complete. And conclude my presentation, I would like to quote from a letter that Sheikh Tantawi, who used the late Sheikh Al-Azhar, the most senior Islamic religious authority, and he wrote to me in a letter that we should recognize that the knowledge is the basis for the understanding and ignorance is the mother of hatred. So the first important element in order to create culture of peace between nations, between cultures, between individuals is knowledge, is meeting, is talking, is creating a rapport and maintaining a dialogue and learning of one of the concerns of the other. So knowledge, this is the basis for understanding and respect. And so being here in Salt Lake City and feeling the very special religious spirit that prevails, I would like, particularly that I attended some of the events connected with the General Conference of the Mormon Church, I would like to conclude my presentation with three verses from the Bible. May the Lord give strength to his people. May the Lord bless his people with peace. Depart from evil and do good. Seek peace and pursue it. Steadfast love and faithfulness will meet. Righteousness and peace will kiss each other. Thank you, shalom, and peace on you. And God bless you all. Thank you very much.
Now, I believe we have some time for a few questions, so if you have a question, please raise your hand, and I'll bring the mic by. And please say your full name when you're asking a question.
Hi, my name is Nancy Wright. I'm a junior here studying biology. I have a quick question. You were talking about how you want the U.S. to aid the Middle East so that we can get peace. And I was curious, what sort of aid is required for that peace to be assured? Fiscal, do we need people over there? I'm curious as to what aid you were talking with respect to.
The United States, there was a treaty signed between Israel and Egypt in 1979, the United States, since then, was giving support, substantial one, in the scope of $1.8 billion for Egypt. And there is another part that is provided for Israel, and this is covered by the last arrangement was signed during the George W. Bush administration in 2007 for 10 years. For Israel, it includes half economic aid and half military aid. Now it is the trend is to reduce the economic and to raise the military. That's for the Israeli. There is no issue with the Israeli side at the moment, but there is an issue with what should be the position of the United States given the changes that took place in 2013 when large demonstrations went to the street in Tahrir Square. That's the second round of this similar demonstrations. And after the government of Morsi could not handle the situation, the army intervened in favor of the masses, the democratic street democracy that is now the style of the people to express themselves in not only in the Middle East, Tunisia, Libya, Egypt, but also even in Europe. Let's see what is happening in Ukraine. So this style of street democracy it raises an intellectual issue. How do you define response by army, which we dislike normally, because everything has to be civilian? But how do you define a response by the army in favor of the street democracy? Do you define it as a revolution, popular revolution, to be supported, and therefore the army is really responding positively to the will of the people? And therefore the United States should continue the aid to the government of Egypt, which is now in transition and is going to hold elections, or should the United States hold a strict view about what has happened and to define it negatively, that the intervention of the army is not accepted? This is the issue. My view is that the United States should follow a more flexible interpretation of the events and define it as a popular revolution coming from the people, and the response by the army is a response that should be looked at as not as critically as one could adopt if one would follow a strict approach.
I'm Wayne McCormick from the law school. Shimon, as you can imagine, I probably have about 200 questions that could come from this talk. I'll limit it just to your last point. Following that same logic, would that mean that the U.S. should embrace a Russian intervention into the eastern Ukraine to protect the Russian populace of eastern Ukraine when they take to the streets? Does it matter when you're transnational versus local?
The comparison, I think, is totally different, because in Egypt it is internally a dispute that arose as a result of the dissatisfaction of the population vis-a-vis its own government, on the question of economy, on the question of excessive domination by the Muslim Brotherhood of either the judiciary or the army or the civil service, and the lack of ability to do a shared democracy as people expected, but rather an exclusive one sector dominates. So this is internal matter, and the army is taking part in this internal situation, but foreign intervention is absolutely and totally different, and of course I wouldn't even think of supporting such an intervention by foreign powers, whether by pretext or by any kind of game that the foreign power is called by a local group to come and rescue it. This, I think, is wrong and unacceptable.
Now, I believe that is all the time we have. Please join me in thanking our guest. Thank you.